This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, coming to you today from KUNC in Greeley, Colorado. And this hour, we're featuring research from Colorado-based scientists, including what we can learn about love from rodents. I'm talking about voles and how a tiny mite is wreaking havoc on honeybee colonies. But first, this week, there was an unexpected hydrothermal explosion at Yellowstone National Park. That's a few miles northwest of Old Faithful Geyser in the Biscayne Basin thermal area. Joining me now to give us the latest on that explosion, plus other top science stories of the week, is Alex Hager, who covers water in the West for KUNC. He's based in Fort Collins. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me again, Ira.
So what's going on here with that explosion?
Oh, man, it was really dramatic. If you watch a video of it, it's this giant plume of steam and rock shooting into the sky and people running away on the boardwalk there. And fortunately, nobody was injured, but it is this really spectacular reminder of just how much heat and force sits under the surface at Yellowstone.
And do we have any idea what caused it?
Well, scientists say the explosion was probably caused by water heating up from some of that underground geothermal activity and then hitting a clog in that kind of natural plumbing system beneath the surface. And when all that water turns to steam, it's building a ton of pressure. It needs somewhere to go. But when it hits that clog, boom. And so in the grand scheme of things, this could have been worse. Thousands of years ago, Yellowstone was seeing similar explosions that made craters more than a mile wide.
Yeah. Wow. Because it sits on the top of a dormant volcano.
That's right. It sits on this big dormant volcano, which that kind of underground activity played a role in heating up the water. But scientists say that fortunately, it does not seem there have been any big shifts that will, you know, be bringing lava spewing from the surface anytime soon.
Good to hear that. Now, there's another big surprise, but we're going to get that one in space from NASA's Curiosity Mars rover, which discovered pure sulfur literally by accident on the red planet, right?
Yeah, that's right. Since late last year, the Curiosity rover has been rolling around this part of the planet that's full of salty minerals called sulfates. Scientists think they were left behind by streams and ponds that evaporated billions of years ago. So this week, the rover was rolling around looking for something interesting, and it rolled right over a rock that broke open. And inside, there were these bright yellow crystals of pure sulfur, which have never been seen before on Mars.
Must have surprised scientists just a bit, huh?
It definitely did. It raises a ton of big questions for scientists, even though they don't know exactly what it means. There's one researcher working on the Curiosity rover who said that finding a whole field of pure sulfur is like, quote, finding an oasis in the desert. He said it shouldn't be there. So now we have to explain it.
Wow, well, that is really interesting. Back on Earth here, most of us are very familiar with how climate change is melting glaciers and polar ice sheets. But new research shows that this is also making our days slightly longer. How does this work?
Well, the planet is getting hotter, and as a result, a lot of that ice stored at our planet's poles is melting. So instead of solid water, we have liquid water that can move away from the poles and toward the equator. Oh. So we're kind of shifting the Earth's center of gravity a little bit. That means the Earth is going to move differently, so much so that it is making the day longer.
How much?
So far, it's a pretty tiny change. The day is only getting a little more than a millisecond longer each year. But that is faster than it was before we started to see this 21st century era of climate change.
Does it mean anything important? I mean, it's nice little factoid, but does it have any ramifications or implications?
To me, this just shows that, you know, there are huge, irreparable, wide-reaching problems that are going to keep happening if we don't hit the brakes on climate change, not just with living things, but with the planet itself. And if climate change gets worse, we keep putting a lot of emissions into the atmosphere, the rate at which the day is getting longer could double.
And could that change how we keep track of time, for example?
Yeah, that's right. So far, we have been using the rotation of the Earth to calibrate our instruments and timing measurements, and that could be thrown a little out of whack.
For us, it's really nothing but a couple of milliseconds for timing is...
Seriously.
For stuff to travel near the speed of light, that's a long time. Our next story that you brought us is also about climate change, and we've talked on the show about how Lake Powell is shrinking, but you actually went out, right, on a reporting trip in Glen Canyon to see some of the scientists who were studying the effects of the lake drying up, and tell us what you found, what they're studying.
Yeah, that's right. I was just down there last week, actually, baking under the triple digit desert summer heat. This is one I'm really excited to talk about because in a weird way, it's kind of a positive outcome of climate change.
Really?
Yeah. Lake Powell's the nation's second largest reservoir, and the levels of water stored in there are dropping. Basically, climate change means less water is flowing in, and people have not been able to rein in their demand. So we've got the supply-demand imbalance. The level of water is going down. That is not great for our ability to have enough water for taps and irrigated farm fields. Right. But what it is good for is the plants and animals that live in Glen Canyon, that lived there before the area was put underwater.
Oh, so they're coming back to life again because there's not that much water to kill them.
Ira, nature is healing. And I went to go see it happen in action. I went out with these scientists, Seth Arnes and Katie Woodward. They're doing this research with a nonprofit group called the Glen Canyon Institute. And they're surveying which plants are coming back. And they're finding out that it's a lot of native plants. They're going canyon by canyon, taking measurements, and seeing that a lot of plants that were there decades ago in areas that have been underwater for decades are able to take root again. And it's bringing back these thriving ecosystems. Even though you're in the middle of the desert, they've got these little creeks running through canyons. They're full of life. They smell like growth. You can see little frogs jumping around and birds chirping. It's
really
special.
You saw all this stuff.
I saw it all with my own two eyes.
And it was surprising to you to be there and see this stuff. Did you get any impression that maybe with the rainfalls that we're having and the increase in water, that maybe there will be a reversal in the dropping down levels of the lake and bring it back to normal levels the way they used to be?
There has been a little bit of a reversal, but in the grand scheme of things, it's relatively small. So Lake Powell gets most of its water from melting snow in the Rocky Mountains. In fact, 60% of the water in Lake Powell started as snow right here in the state of Colorado.
Right.
And we had a relatively strong year last year. But at the end of the day, we are in deep. We're over more than two decades of mega drought.
Right.
And it is going to take more than one snow a year to turn that around. It's going to take serious reductions to demand from the cities and farms that use its water.
This next one is a whale of a story. I always got to have to get that in there. Specifically about the spade-tooth whale, which locals found washed up on a beach in New Zealand. I saw pictures of this. Tell us why this is such an extraordinary discovery.
Well, this spade-tooth whale is an incredibly rare species. Just to visualize it, looks a little bit more like probably what you would imagine when you visualize a dolphin than when you think of a whale. It's about 15 feet long. It's a type of beaked whale, and they live super deep in the ocean. We know almost nothing about them. This particular species, the spade-toothed whale, has never been seen alive. Since the 1800s, we've only seen hints of this animal six times, like little bone fragments or degraded pieces of a whale's corpse that were kind of past the point of being able to be studied by scientists.
But this was not a live whale, right?
This was not a live whale, but it was very intact.
And so they got the whole whale that they've never seen before. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. So what's next for the whale? Obviously, scientists are going to take it apart or look at it.
Yeah, they're keeping it in a fridge right now and taking DNA samples, and they sound really excited. One researcher said spade-toothed whales are one of the most poorly known large mammal species of modern times.
What a find, right? A lot of stories about exciting scientists this week and stuff we're finding. And here's a new study in the journal Nature about psilocybin, and it looks at how the drug rewires our brain? Tell us, what did they find?
Yeah, this is a new study in the journal Nature that shows just how magic mushrooms work on your brain. So we're talking about psilocybin. That's the substance in mushrooms that makes you hallucinate. So scientists did brain scans before, during, and after people took a dose, and they found that psilocybin entirely resets some of the neurons in your brain for a short period of time, sometimes a long period of time. And these are the pathways that allow you to have a sense of time and self. And one of the researchers at the Harvard School of Medicine said the changes were so massive that the brains of some of the test subjects resembled the brain of a different person entirely.
No kidding.
Yeah.
that is amazing. And I imagine this could help researchers better understand, you know, how to harness the drug for therapeutic means, right?
That's right. This opens the door even further for psilocybin use in medicine. It's been getting a lot of traction as something that could be potentially helpful in therapy for mental health conditions like depression right. or post-traumatic stress disorder. So this gives health experts a little more context on how exactly psilocybin impacts the brain and, you know, paves the way for more use of magic mushrooms in medicinal use.
We always have to warn our listeners that this is just basic research and you can't go out and, you know, just ask your doctor for a psilocybin treatment yet.
Yeah, don't try everything you hear on the radio at home.
All right. Speaking of mind bending, this is our last story. It is about battery bending, and scientists have created soft, super stretchy jelly batteries.
That's right. It's from a team at the University of Cambridge in the UK, and they created these squishy, bendable batteries that were actually inspired by electric eels. So they can conduct electricity while still being squishable and bendable, and they can be stretched to 10 times their original length without breaking and then return to their original size. That is thanks to a material called hydrogel, which is more than 60% water.
Wow. Well, I guess if they're bendable, you could put them on places that where batteries need to be bent, right? Like clothing, something like that?
That's right.
Wearables or?
That's right. Yeah, wearable technologies are one of the potential uses for these jelly batteries. But scientists think this could go even further. These batteries that are soft and tough at the same time, they could someday be implanted in the body. It kind of has some properties of human tissue, so it could be implanted in the brain to help deliver drugs or treat conditions like epilepsy.
How far off are the jelly batteries from us using them? This is obviously basic research, and we're not going to see the jelly battery for quite a while, I imagine.
This seems like it's in the early stages. I don't exactly know how far off it is, but it does seem like a promising opening of the door to new batteries that could be used inside your body.
Alex, always good to have you on. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Alex Hager, who covers water in the West for KUNC. He's based in Fort Collins, Colorado. We have to take a break, and when we come back, what studying voles can teach us about a very human emotion. I'm talking about love. Yes. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Remember that famous song, Love Potion Number 9? That little bottle of elixir that smelled like turpentine, looked like India ink? Well, is there something in our bodies that turns on love, like in the song? You know, love is a hard thing to study, and my next guest works to understand the neurobiology behind love, and she does so with some unusual subjects, prairie voles. Dr. Zoe Donaldson, Associate Professor of Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Can science really quantify what love is?
You know, I think scientists typically dodge this question by coming up with other terms, right? So we talk about pair bonding, which is kind of the scientific word for falling in love. And I think this is because when we talk about love, it's really this human emotion that we can talk about in literature, we encapsulate in art. And it's pretty hard to ask how those things, our literature, our art, et cetera, have an equivalent in other animals.
Okay, so tell me why prairie voles are a good species to use for understanding these bonds.
So prairie voles are these little tennis ball-sized rodents, and they live in the prairie states. So basically from Colorado over to western Pennsylvania, from Canada down to Oklahoma. And what makes them notable is that whether it's in the wild or in the laboratory, they will form these lifelong mating-based bonds. And this is incredibly rare. So fewer than 10% of mammalian species are capable of this. We are definitely capable of this. And your more traditional laboratory rodents, like mice and rats, they fall in this more traditional category of mate and leave.
So, okay, so tell me how this works. How do you study it? What do you look for in the body of the voles?
So a good place to begin with this question is, how do you ask a vole if they've formed a bond with their mating partner?
Very, very difficult to do that.
So we try to simplify things as much as possible. And the way we do this is in a way that's sort of equivalent to what I think of as dating, right? So if you go to a bar with your partner, you're probably going to spend most of your time talking to them and not talking to someone that you don't know. And so we set up an equivalent scenario for the voles, where basically they can choose to go interact with their mating partner, or they can go and choose to interact with some opposite sex vole that they don't know. And what's really striking is that when they have formed these bonds, they just want to go over and they want to huddle with their partner. And we test this for 3 hours, and they do this for the vast majority of the test time. And it's quite adorable. And it looks totally different from a mouse or rat, where if it's a male and they've already mated with one of the females, they actually don't even like that female anymore. And they want to spend most of their time with the female they've not yet mated with.
You don't characterize this as a romantic attachment here, do you?
I think that there are a lot of parallels between our romantic attachments and what we're studying in the voles, right? And so a really simple one is that your attachments, especially your romantic attachments, make you feel good.
Right.
And we know that these bonds also make voles feel good. They find them highly rewarding and highly motivating.
Is it, though, a different kind of bond you would see in voles, for example, versus a bond between a parent and child?
So we don't know the exact answer to this, but the short is that there's a lot of overlap and there's some things that are different, right? So at the end of the day, there are certain things that we share across all of our bonds. So one of the scientific terms that we use a lot is proximity seeking, and that just basically amounts to we like to be around that individual. And so this applies to pretty much all of our bonds, right? Like we like to be, if we're a toddler, we really like to be around our parents. If we have friends, we like to be around them. We like to be around our romantic partners. But there's also some differences. Obviously, there's right. behaviors we engage in with romantic partners that we don't engage in with parents and with friends. And so I think a big open question is, you know, what's shared in the brain, what's shared across these bonds, and then what enables these distinct differences in behavior that characterize different types of bonds that we form.
So neurologically, then, what is shared across the neurons?
So we think that some of what is shared is probably the basic underlying structure, right? So all the behaviors that we share across these bonds, like the facts that we find them rewarding, we're motivated to seek out these individuals, we want to be near them, that's probably a pretty common underlying architecture within the brain.
Is there a certain neurotransmitter that you see more of?
Yeah, so there's sort of a suite of neurotransmitters, but the most famous one is oxytocin. And so this is a small hormone. It's produced by your brain, but it actually does a whole bunch of different things. One of the things it's best known for is actually inducing labor.
Wow.
Yeah. So they give Pitocin, which is a synthetic version of oxytocin, which induces labor. And that was one of the first things that was learned about oxytocin as a hormone was its function in reproduction. And then a few scientists thought, hey, you know what? Rats do this weird thing where when they're a virgin and they've never given birth before, they don't like pups. But as soon as they've given birth, there's this switch in the brain where they just desperately want to take care of their pups. And there's this great series of experiments. We call them the pupperator experiments, where they give a female rat who's just given birth, they give her a little lever and she can press the lever and they'll deliver a pup to her. And she'll just keep pressing this lever until she has a mountain of pups so big that she couldn't possibly take care of all of them.
No kidding.
She's super motivated, and it's this shift in behavior, and that shift in behavior to wanting to take care of pups is mediated by oxytocin.
Is this love potion number 9, oxytocin?
It's part of the love potion. I would say that the love potion is actually really complex, right? So in addition to oxytocin, you also have dopamine. You have another hormone called vasopressin. There's probably a role for serotonin. So it's a really complex mixture of things that's happening in the brain. Oxytocin is essential, but you can't just throw oxytocin at someone and have them fall in love with you.
Wow, this is really interesting. I know you also studied prairie vole breakups. Do they have broken hearts?
They do. Yeah. So prairie vole broken hearts look a lot like human broken hearts. They show a lot of different types of behavioral distress when they're separated from their partner. They show behaviors that are reminiscent of depression. And then one of the areas that my lab has been really actively working in is trying to figure out what is special about these breakups or even the loss of a partner compared to these other things like depression. And we think the key to this is actually yearning. So yearning is something you see only, you know, after a breakup or after the loss of a loved one. And it's something that differentiates those losses from, say, just general depression. So one of the things we see in the voles is that they're actually a little bit more motivated to seek out their partner if they haven't seen them in a while. So this is the whole absence makes the heart grow fonder idea.
Wow. Who would think that animals had the same kind of feelings that humans did? Is this surprising to you when you studied this?
This is actually why I fell in love with the voles.
Really?
Yeah. This is what motivated me to become a social neuroscientist and to start studying attachment, because as humans, if we think about the most important things in our lives, we usually start talking about having kids, getting married. you know, loss of a parent or someone else who's incredibly important to us. And so I thought, you know, I want to study these things that we find fundamentally important. And then I started thinking how we could do this. And it was clear that mice and rats have some real limitations since they don't form these bonds. And the more that we learn, the more I'm impressed by, you know, the conservation of how our brain works. It's just there's a blueprint for the brain. And so it's not totally surprising that these complex emotions that we feel as humans have some basic representation even in other species.
So you think there's like a correlation between what's going on with the vole's brain and what's going on in our brain?
Yes, that's the premise to all of our research, because the idea is that what we discover in the voles may help guide us to develop new therapies. And so there's a couple of directions this could go. One is that the vast majority of sort of neuropsychiatric disorders throughout the life course can affect our attachments. And this begins even early in life. It manifests in things like autism spectrum disorders. It also, if you think of things like schizophrenia and depression, you can have a reduction in your sort of attachments and how much social reward you feel. And later in life, you have things like neurodegenerative disorders, which have huge impacts on relationships. And also people start displaying sort of inappropriate behaviors in relationships or even just social withdrawal.
So why are we spending so much time studying rat brains about what's going on in our brains and not vole brains?
So rats and mice are excellent models for many, many things. And there's parallels with humans. If you want to understand how the brain makes your arm move, or if you want to even understand just basic anxiety states or hunger or thirst, we share those with rats and mice. What we don't share with rats and mice is our really complex socio-emotional behaviors.
All right. So what is there yet to be studied in the vole brains, comparing them to us, that you would like to study? And I'll give you my blank check question. I give a lot of scientists, if you had all the money in the world and you could spend it on anything to learn more about what you want to know, what would you spend it on? What do you want to know?
So I really want to know fundamentally, how are these bonds encoded in the brain, but also how are they plastic at the same time? So what unique features of our brain make it so that we can form these bonds, but we can also lose these bonds and we can adapt to that loss? And I want to fundamentally understand, what is it about our neurons and their firing properties and the different inputs they get from hormones, et cetera, that enables this incredible complexity? And this complexity is something that defines us as humans. If anything, we take what voles can do and we just basically add steroids to it, right? Like, we have terminology like frenemy. I doubt the voles have frenemies. But the complexity of the social behavior that we can study in voles compared to other models, I think, really just gives us a lot to work with and a lot that can tell us something about the human condition.
Very interesting. One last question for you. So after this study, do you believe in life after love, as Cher would ask?
Oh, absolutely. So the vast majority of us will lose someone in our lifetime. And for about half of us, we will lose a spouse. And so the idea that there isn't life after love is a pretty depressing idea. This is the plasticity that I mentioned. This is why I'm so fascinated with it, because we do have the ability to integrate these losses. It's not like we forget the people that we lost, but we have to sort of rework the memories that we have with them and what they mean to us. And so one of my favorite sort of terminologies is actually from a clinician that I work with, who says that those memories have to go from painful to bittersweet.
Yeah. Wow. What a way to end our conversation. I have learned so much today. Thank you for this lesson on love, Dr. Donaldson.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Zoe Donaldson, Associate Professor of Behavioral Neuroscience. That's at the University of Colorado in Boulder. We are in Boulder, Colorado this week. And while we're here, we're going to check in on their state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
Iowa Public Radio News.
Local stories of national significance. Colorado has the highest average elevation of any U.S. state, thanks to the Rocky Mountains. But think about this. What if you squished those giant mountains down, turning Colorado into, let's say, I don't know, a nice ooey-gooey brownie? Just how big would that brownie be? Here to answer that very important question is Dan Boyce, reporter at Colorado Public Radio in Colorado Springs. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira. Great to be with you.
Nice to have you, Dan. So where did this wild idea come from?
I love it so much. We got the question from a listener, a Denver resident named Howard Paul.
I spent a lot of time in the outdoors, and I think about brownies and German chocolate cake and so on. How large would Colorado be if I used a giant rolling pin and rolled it flat to 1 inch thick?
That's really cool. Now, I would hypothesize that it would be somewhere, you know, not as big as the U.S. What did you think?
I would take Howard's idea. He was thinking that it's probably going to be bigger than Texas, but smaller than Alaska. Sounded like a great guess to me. You know, what do I know?
Yeah,
bigger
yeah.
than Texas, smaller than Alaska. I'll go for that. Great hypothesis.
I would go with that. So how do you even begin to calculate how big Colorado would be as a brownie?
Well, I'll be clear. First off, I did absolutely zero calculations for this. My first thought is I'm going to check to see if anybody else has ever approached the question. And it turned out that there was this short article in this 2005 edition of Ski Magazine, and they asked, how big would Colorado be if you steamrolled all the mountains? That sounds pretty close. And the conclusion of that article, it basically said that it would increase the state's footprint by 2,500 square miles, which would be a little bit bigger than Delaware. I thought that was a little anticlimactic, but I'm trying to justify this to myself. I'm thinking, okay, that's not exactly what Howard's question was. It's not exactly the same thing. And so I went up to the U.S. Geological Survey. They have this office in Denver, and it was so humbling. They just put a team of researchers on this.
Oh, they didn't think it was a crazy idea. They wanted to know, huh?
They seemed genuinely curious about it, and they really nerded out over finding the answer. And Kim Manti, she headed that team. She's the director of the USGS National Geospatial Technical Operations Center. So they're looking at this question, Ira, and they're saying the parameters that you set for answering something like this, that's what makes all the difference in the world.
Like you got to put your mountains and your fields and your buildings and everything in there before you make a brownie.
They actually debated that very question.
Believe it or not, this was one of the questions we asked ourselves. Do you want bare ground or do you want trees and buildings as a part of this exercise?
I will say they actually did decide not to do that. They're going to go just from the bare ground. But that's just one of the many parameters they had to consider. They're thinking, are we squishing Colorado? Are we going all the way down to sea level? Are we going to go to the core of the earth? They're debating that.
Right.
They decided to go, all right, we're going to go to Colorado's lowest elevation. And then one of the most important parameters they needed to figure out is they found out that that 2005 Ski Magazine article, the methodology that that group of USGS researchers used was they stretched out the surface area. So picture that you have the topmost layer of Colorado. It's like a giant scrunched up blanket. And the analysts, they took that giant scrunched up blanket and they just stretched it flat. So that's what they did in 2005. But Howard's question, it was very different. You know, he's talking about rolling everything from the ground, but everything absolutely underneath the ground, all the dirt, all of the rock, to this minuscule size of 1 inch thick. And that's how we ended up with the answer.
And Dan, I'm on the edge of my seat. How big is the Colorado brownie?
Let me get you some reference points here, Ira. So Colorado's surface area before our rolling pin squish, 104,000 square miles. Now let's get the final answer from USGS analyst Barry Miller. He's the one who crunched the final numbers.
4,419,041,096.31 square miles.
Wow.
We're talking 4.5 billion now. So to think of this another way, rolling out Colorado to 1 inch thick leaves us with a surface area that is 22 times larger than the surface area of the planet Earth. Here's how Howard Paul reacted to that.
What? That is one big friggin' brownie. We're going to have to bake it in sections.
So what do you do with this information now? Bragging rights? You give it to the local chamber of commerce, you know, the tourist board?
You know, I think as far as bragging rights, sure, you know, whatever, if we want. It's important for us to recontextualize and remember that we are comparing a squished Colorado to these unsquished reference points. And so how would Colorado compare to a squished Texas? That question, it still, you know, unfortunately remains unanswered. But Kim Manti, the woman who led the team at the U.S. Geological Survey, she said her team is now really quite interested in performing the squish exercise for all 50 states.
Well, Dan, you have provided us, I think, with one of the most unusual state of science reports ever. So thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Boy, it is my pleasure, Ira. You're welcome.
Dan Boyce is a reporter at Colorado Public Radio. He's based in Colorado Springs. After the break, teeny tiny parasites are feasting on honeybee guts, and scientists are trying to stop them. Stay with us. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now in the peak of summer, honeybees are busy collecting pollen, making honey, and preparing for the winter ahead. And if you're a beekeeper, there's one thing you don't want to find in your hives: gnarly little mites. Last year, sci-fi producer Rasha Aridi came out to Boulder, Colorado to learn more. And since Sci-Fry is in Boulder this week, we're resharing that story. Tell us more, Rasha.
Yeah, as you said, there's a teeny tiny mite that is absolutely wreaking havoc on honeybee populations. I went out to Colorado and I met Dr. Sammy Ramsey, an entomologist at CU Boulder, and his team of bee experts. They're working on studying this mite, so they hopefully one day can take it down. I met them in this beautiful field nestled among Boulder's rolling hills. Right off the main road, there are around 15 beehives all lined up next to each other. And we were going parasite hunting.
The name for this parasite is a very transformery sounding name, but it's actually called Varroa destructor. So these Varroa destructor mites have earned this name. It's not melodramatic by any means. They are incredibly destructive organisms. We lose between a third and half of our bee colonies, like nationally, every year.
Because of these mites?
The primary driving factor is Varroa destructor. There are other things that are going on, and I don't want to make it seem like there is a single problem. It's multifactorial. But what we do know is that these parasites are at the center of the web of problems. Because pesticides are one issue, but because the parasite literally feeds on the tissue that breaks down pesticides, pesticides are a lot more deadly when they are around. In addition to that, poor nutrition is a big issue for bees, but it becomes a huger issue when they feed on the tissue that stores excess nutrition and allows them to get through these dearths in their nutritional context.
So the mites eat the bee stomach, like a smoothie, a bee smoothie?
It is actually a bee smoothie in a lot of ways. So it's referred to as the fat body, and the fat body does the job of the liver of the bee. It's a part of their like endocrine system. It regulates their hormones, regulates their immune system, and it also stores nutrients and regulates their metabolism. In addition to all of that, you can't eat normal stuff because if there's any toxic component to it, you can't break it down.
So it wouldn't kill the bees as much as make their lives miserable?
It makes their lives miserable enough that oftentimes they die as a result, especially from viruses that they come in contact with. The tough part now is that when colonies start collapsing, the bees that lived inside of those colonies that no longer have a place to live will begin to drift to any nearby colonies that they can go to. And the worst part about that is the mites that you get under those circumstances are likely to be a lot more virulent. Just like there are different strains of COVID-19 that can cause all kinds of issues, there are more virulent strains of Varroa. The ones that kill a colony and then their bees fly over to yours and then deposit their mites there, those are typically more virulent mites.
Oh no.
Yeah.
These mites are too good.
They are. And I mean, honestly, it's not just that the mites are too good. It's that the bees have never dealt with something like this before.
Our honeybee is not native to the U.S. It evolved in Europe, and colonists brought the species over with them. The Varroa mites, on the other hand, evolved in Southeast Asia. The bees over there can deal with the mites pretty well, but the European honeybees can't. They didn't evolve to, which makes them very susceptible to infestations.
What about the native bees? They also wouldn't have encountered these evil little mites, right?
The good thing about these evil little mites, if I can say that there's a good thing about them, these mites are very species specific. They have attuned themselves to the life cycle of the bees, to the exact timeline of the bees, to the endocrine system of the bees, the different levels of hormones and things. And so they can't just offload themselves into a bumblebee colony and expect that they're going to be successful. We have never seen them reproducing in bumblebees and wasps, even though sometimes they'll accidentally end up in one of those colonies. They just can't seem to make it work.
Ah, so those other bees just kind of lucked out.
They did luck out. The problem is there's another parasite currently spreading around the world that is related to Varroa destructor, but its populations grow much more quickly, and it is the least species specific.
No!
Yes, it's called the tropimite. My research is divided between Varroa mites in the U.S., and then I go to Asia for about 3 months every year and study the tropimites there, because my goal is to make sure we don't take our eye off the ball.
Now that I know exactly what we're dealing with, we're ready to open up a hive.
During the height of the summer, there's thousands upon thousands of these little hexagonal cells in the colony that have a developing baby bee inside. The queen lays an egg. In a matter of days, that egg hatches, turns into a larva. That larva spends a few days developing into a pupa. And it's at this stage, right before it turns into a pupa, where the parasite jumps inside. Now, the bees try to put a layer of wax over the cell to stop parasites from getting in there. And the parasites have learned what the larva smells like right before it's about to get capped. So they have totally outsmarted the bees and learned to jump in. And instead of the cap protecting the larva from the parasite, it protects the parasite from the bees and from our pesticides.
Inside the hive that Sammy wanted to crack open, there were around 20,000 bees, which is a fairly small colony. And for the bees to let us in, we had to distract them.
All right, ladies. When we pump this smoke at them, they start sticking their heads inside of the cells and consuming honey because it mimics the experience of there being a forest fire in the area. The behavior that they then have under that set of circumstances is, we should probably consume as much of the honey as we can, store it in our honey stomachs, because we're going to have to fly off with it if this fire gets too close to us. And so it gives them something else to worry about as top priority instead of you. All right, ladies. Let's see what's happening with your babies. Let me see if I can get a nice little frame out here for you.
And then it was time to shake off the bees, shoo them away so that we could take a closer look at the cells and try to find some with baby honeybees that could be carrying the varroa mites.
So I've taken to like counting the three in random languages when I do this.
Nice. What language are we getting today?
Japanese. Ichi, ni, san. Right? Oh, wow, this frame might be the one.
By the one, Sammy means a hive full of varroa mites.
There's a varroa mite sitting right on the body of this bee. Right there, that red bump that's on the back of the bee.
It looks like a little bug pimple.
It does look like a little bug pimple. This little bug pimple is unfortunately mobile, and if it were a pimple, proportionally it'd be the size of your hand.
What?
Yes. It's one of the largest external parasite body ratios that we see in the scientific world.
So at this point, right in front of us is a tray that looks like a giant sheet of honeycomb. There are bees ducking in and out of the tiny, sticky, hexagonal cells.
Some of these cells, like the rim of the cell, is just a little bit higher up than it is in the others. And those are cells where the larva has finally reached the age where they are teenagers. And so they've reached a point where they are about to be capped, and the parasites know this.
The cells that are capped or covered with wax kind of look like someone shoved a yellow crayon through them. We can't see inside, so we have no idea if there's any unlucky baby bees with varroa mites chewing on them.
And so we're going to grab some of them, we're going to take them to the lab, and we're going to hope that if there are parasites inside the cell, we can transfer them into our imaging system. Normally, what goes on under these cell cappings is not quite a mystery to us, but it's very hard for us to actually discern because it's pitch black inside of the colony. So you can't see anything and it's too small to get a camera inside. We've created these artificial cells in the lab that are made of beeswax, but two of the walls of the hexagon is replaced with high optical clarity glass. So you can actually position them in an incubator that I've designed to have a microscope and a camera over it. And then you can watch what the parasites are doing inside of the cell instead of what we used to do, where we would just open the cell at random intervals and say, okay, that's what they were doing at, you know, 2 hours in, at 5 hours in, at 3 days in, at 10 days in. Now we get to watch the entire process start to finish. So if you want to see the next part of this process, we're going to head back to the lab at CU Boulder, the Boulder Bee Lab.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
I'm excited.
Sammy and his team packed up a couple frames from the beehives into a carrier. It looked like a briefcase full of honeycomb. We drove over to Sammy's lab to get a close-up view to see how exactly he can spy on baby bees and what he can learn from doing so.
So we have just arrived in the Boulder Bee Lab, and now the hands-on part of actually moving the mites into these cells gets to be conducted.
Sammy and his team started by taking out one of the frames that we brought with us in the bee briefcase. They propped it up on a stand so that they could see every little cell, and they opened up each capped cell very tediously, one by one by one, to see if any of the babies nestled inside of them had mites feeding on their guts.
So we're going to lift the bee up, look for the mite, and then if that bee has a mite, we're going to transfer the mite, the brood food, and the bee into one of our artificial cells.
Dr. Madison Sankovitz, a postdoc in Sammy's lab, showed me how to do this.
So I'm going to use these sharp forceps to open up one of these cells so I can kind of cut around the wax capping.
It looks like earwax.
Oh, yeah. It is essentially earwax. So close, so close. There's this little baby bee I'm pulling out of here.
It looks like a little grub, or to be frank, like a booger.
Totally. Oh, wow. Yes. Grub / booger. Both are acceptable. And then, there's a varroa mite in this cell. We hit the jackpot.
This particular bee is going to become an experiment. She's going to survive, but unfortunately, the parasite that was already inside of this cell with her is just going to continue doing what it would have done otherwise under our watchful eyes. So no bees will be murdered in the making of this cell unless the mite murders them. And then that will unfortunately be a data point.
That boogery bee will get packed into a little glass chamber. It kind of looks like the very top of a mechanical pencil. And inside its little room, it has everything it needs. Baby food, a bed of wax, and, of course, a varroa mite.
So because I want to keep this system as natural as possible, I'm taking the cap off of a cell that was just capped by a bee. And so if there are any potential pheromones or things that these mites need to smell in this process, I'm going to make sure that they do that. So we're putting the cap on here.
So the goal is like neither the bee or the mite really notice that they are not in the hive anymore.
That is exactly the goal. And it is a hard goal to pull off because honeybees work so hard to make that hive such a distinct home.
Once the bee is tucked into its little cell, it gets placed into a one-of-a-kind imaging machine. It maintains perfect humidity and heat and has cameras that spy on the bees for about 10 days as they go from a slimy-looking larva to a beautiful honeybee. Sammy and his team call it the Mite Insight System.
What do you learn from spying on them and like watching them do this and invading all of their privacy?
I am invading their privacy, and it's very important that I do so because before, when people wanted to see what was going on with the mites, they had to open individual cells after a certain amount of time, and the influx of air into the cell lets the mite know the jig is up. They know I'm here, and they stop doing all the things they were doing before. They stop reproducing. They will sometimes continue to feed, but most of the time they'll just try to get out of the cell. At that point, you've created a stop-motion system where you can tell what was going on the moment you opened the cell, but before and after is a mystery. Well, I'm tired of those mysteries. I want to see everything that happens here, and I want to be able to catalog all the different behaviors and how long they're doing each thing, and discover if there are any potentially weak links in their life cycle. And so what we end up doing here is by filming all 10 days that they're running around down here inside of the cell, we have the opportunity to really see all the different things that they're doing and actually catalog all of it and turn it into a data set.
For example, Sammy can see if and how a baby honeybee could take down a mite. One way the bees do this is with silk, which they use to build their cocoons. If the bee picks up on a mite, it'll go into a frenzy and bolt that mite down to the bottom of the cell using silk fibers. The key is for the bee to do this before the mite latches on.
It only takes like 3 or 4 silk fibers, and that mite can't get up anymore. And so I'm wondering, is there a way that we can jumpstart that ability and kind of more strongly encourage them to do this really fast? Because if they can outsmart the mites at this stage of the life cycle, they can stop them from hopping on their face and doing all the nefarious things they do during the rest of the time these bees are in the cell.
Watching the mites chow down on the bees in the imaging system also gives Sammy and his team insights into how the mite keeps itself alive.
Oh, do you see that varroa mite running around in there? So both mites survived, but did not reproduce. Why? All right, so here's the thing. There is a infertility rate in colonies that ranges wildly, and we don't know why. The last paper I read about it was like between 8 and 62% in the study that they did. Like the mites will go into the cell, do their fairly normal behaviors of feeding, but then just for whatever reason, choose not to reproduce. Don't know what's up. Sometimes I will talk about these mites being clever, being fascinating, being interesting, and people bristle at that. But my interest in these mites, my ability to peer into their life cycle and learn about them, it is really, really, really important for us being able to find out the weak links in their life cycle, us being able to find out how to disrupt their capacity to exploit the bees. If we don't understand them, we can't accomplish any of that.
And this imaging system gets really detailed photos and videos of the mites feasting on the baby honeybees' insides, to the point that we can even see their mouth parts move. Sammy walked us over to a computer to show us, very close up, what goes on in the little bee chambers.
Aha! Check this one out. That is a varroa mite with its mouth parts embedded in the fat body tissue of the bee. So all this squishy white stuff that you see here, this is the bee's liver. So you can actually see this mite embedding its mouth parts in this bee. It's wackadoodle.
All this brings us to one last question. How do we beat the varroa destructor mites?
That's a great question. This parasite is now officially a cosmopolitan parasite. It is present pretty much everywhere bees are kept. So we're going to do everything we can to understand them, because in order to beat them, we've got to figure them out. When you're looking at things and you don't know what you're looking for, that's some of the best science happens. We're not looking for anything specific. We're just looking to understand them better than they've been understood previously. And then it's possible that something will present itself. We don't know if it'll be a spray. We don't know if it'll be gene drive or some sort of double-stranded RNA disruption of their genetic code. We don't know yet. But we are going to figure that out by intensely studying these organisms, learning about their reproduction, their feeding, their digestion, their entire life cycle, and then we'll know what options are available to us.
A huge thanks to Dr. Sammy Ramsey, Dr. Madison Sankovitz, and Christopher Borky for speaking with me. I'm Rasha Aridi.
Thank you, Rasha. Many more folks helped make this show happen this week, including
Kathleen Davis,
Diana Plasker,
Danielle Johnson,
Santiago Flores.
Thank you, everybody. We also want to shout out to Desmond O'Boyle and all the other kind folks at KUNC for all of their help in making this show possible. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Here's a trivia question for you. Who has more places named after him than anyone else? Of course, you're thinking George Washington, right? No, not even our first president can claim a Brazilian river, Mexican mountain, a glacier in Greenland, and an area of the moon. Not to mention here in the States, 4 counties and 13 towns. That distinction goes to a globe-trekking explorer, scientist, and environmentalist named Alexander von Humboldt. A guy whose notoriety in the 19th century made him the second most famous man in Europe after Napoleon. Well, that was then, now is now, today he's largely forgotten. But my next guest has been working to change that. Back in 2015, I talked to author and historian Andrea Wolf about her book, The Invention of Nature. In it, she argues that Humboldt did nothing less than change our understanding of nature. It was the overwhelming community choice by members of our Sci-Fi Book Club who will be reading it in August. Andrea, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
If we know the name Humboldt today, it's probably because of Humboldt Park in Chicago, right? We have Humboldt County in California. What was Humboldt's reputation in his day?
Well, he was the most famous scientist of his age, which, you know, seems mad to us now because very few people, at least in the English-speaking world, have heard about him. Every school child in the mid-19th century had heard his name. Every scientist who went to Europe went to Paris, where he lived, or later to Berlin, where he lived, to see him. It was like a rite of passage, basically.
Not even our most famous scientists today are, as you say, as famous as Humboldt. What did he specialize in?
Well, that's the thing. He didn't specialize in anything. He was a genius polymath who really roamed across the disciplines. He was interested in nature as a whole. In fact, he comes up with this concept of nature as an interconnected whole, as nature as a web of life, or we would call it today as an ecosystem, although he didn't use the term. So he was looking at plants, for example, not through the narrow lens of classification as other scientists, but looking at them in terms of their vegetation zones, their habitats, the climate. So he looks at Earth as this living organism.
He sort of like invented ecology.
Yes, he's very much interested in this. I mean, he sees nature almost like as this tapestry where he looks at animals within their habitat, at plants within their habitat. And then because he sees nature as a web of life, he also realizes that nature is threatened. So if you see nature as a tapestry, you basically, when you pull one thread, the whole thing might unravel. So he also becomes the father of environmentalism, really, because he predicts harmful human-induced climate change in 1800.
How did he get interested in all of this? Where does he come from?
So he's this, what I love about him is that he's not this kind of cerebral scholar. He is brazenly adventurous. He comes from a very wealthy Prussian family in Berlin, and when his parents die, he basically spends his entire inheritance on a 5-year exploration of Latin America. And he ventures deep into the rainforest in Venezuela and across the Andes. And he's kind of physically incredibly fit, and he sees all these different parts of the world. And he realizes that there are similarities across continents. So he really defines these kind of global vegetation and climate zones, all these things which we take for absolutely for granted today, but which were completely new at his time.
Mm. You describe, in that vein, you describe a pivotal moment when he climbs up Ecuador's mountain, considered to be the highest in the world at that point. What was so pivotal about that climb?
So he climbs Chimborazo, which is then believed to be the highest mountain in the world, which is about 100 miles south of Quito in today's Ecuador. And he climbs up and he reaches more than 19,000 feet. So no one has ever been that high as he has. And he holds the world record for several decades. And he sees, as he's standing on top of the world, he looks down and his vision of nature clarifies, because what he realizes is that the journey from Quito up to the peak of Chimborazo was like a botanical journey from the equator to the pole. So he sees the tropical species like banana trees and palm trees in the valley. And then the further up he comes, the kind of the plants changes according to altitude. And he realizes that the plants he's seeing on Chimborazo are very similar to some of the plants he's seen before in Europe, say, for example, in the Alps in Switzerland or in the Pyrenees in Spain. So he realizes that there are these corresponding vegetation zones across the globe. So what clarifies at that moment really for him is that nature is a global force. And that's an extraordinary concept to have at that time.
You know, I've got to ask at this point, we've talked so much about him, what happened? I mean, why did his name drop off the map, so to speak?
I think there are several reasons for that. One is, I think, that some of his ideas have become so self-evident almost. We have absorbed them almost by osmosis that we've forgotten the man behind them. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that he's really the last of all polymaths. So he dies in 1859, which is really the last moment where one person can hold all the knowledge of the world in one head, basically, because after that, the sciences specialize so much. So scientists become experts, and they actually look down on people like Humboldt and regard them like amateurs. And then the third reason, which I think is the most important reason, really, is that he is famous until World War I. And then you know, neither America nor England is really the right place to celebrate a German scientist. This is a time when the English royal family, for example, changes their surname to Windsor because their other surname sounded too German, where you have public libraries in America burning German books. So he gets really pushed away. And the interesting thing is that in Latin America, where, you know, he traveled for 5 years, he is famous. He's as famous as Jefferson and Washington is famous here, because he was quite instrumental through his friendship with Simon Bolivar in the revolutions in South America.
But he went all over the place, didn't he? Well, he had a relationship with Charles Darwin.
Yes. Well, Charles Darwin was admired Humboldt. And actually, Charles Darwin said that he would have not boarded the Beagle and therefore not conceived the Origin of Species without Humboldt. So Darwin, as a young man, read Humboldt's books. And that actually made him go to South America. Once he was in South America, Charles Darwin then said that he could really only see the new world through the lens of Humboldt's writings. Then later he modeled his own writings on Humboldt's books, like Voyage of the Beagle is very similar in style. And he also used Humboldt's books as source material, really, while he was working on his evolutionary theory. So he was greatly influenced by Humboldt. But there's this wonderful scene where Darwin meets Humboldt finally in 1842. So this is after the Beagle, and this hero of his, which has really grown to like mythical dimensions in his head, is this old man who's so used to being the center of attention and who just talks all the time, and Darwin can't get a single word in. It's really disappointed.
And he wasn't just analytical. I mean, he believed, right, in bringing emotion to science, or as scientists today try to be emotionless. He thought you had to be committed and emotional.
Yeah, so on the one hand, he's obsessed with measurements. That's why he schleps around his instruments through Latin America. But he also says that we have to use our imagination and our emotions to understand nature. So he really bridges enlightenment and romanticism. But he also provides people like Henry David Thoreau, for example, with an answer to how to bring together poetry and science. And I think, people like John Muir, for example, really follow Humboldt in that, you know, you can only protect nature if you really love nature. So these guys are all driven by this sense of wonder and this love of nature.
Right. You know, it sounds like you're sort of trying to spread the word about Humboldt.
Yes, it's absolutely a mission. It's weird. So this, you know, I've written a few books, and this is for the first time that I don't feel like I'm on a publicity tour for my book. It's like I'm on a publicity tour for Humboldt. I want everyone to know him, because he needs to be restored to his, you know, rightful place in the pantheon of nature and science. He's incredibly important, and he's shaped the way we think about nature, and everyone should know about him.
How do you do that?
Well, I try to tell a good story about him. I try to do him justice with this book. Because I'm German, I was able to kind of read a lot of the German original sources, because he's really suffered from some very bad English translations of his books, because his books are beautiful. And he writes really his writing is a blueprint of all nature writing today, because he combines these evocative landscape descriptions with scientific observation. So, you know, I try my best.
Well, is now a good time? Is the time right in society and culture, environmentalism, global warming, all that stuff?
I think they are, you know, he is incredibly relevant at the moment, because, well, one thing is that his story really explains why we understand nature the way we do it. But he's also, you know, one of his greatest achievements was to make knowledge accessible and popular. He wanted to unite scientists, he wanted to foster communication across disciplines, which is all incredible. You know, these are incredibly important pillars of science today. And probably most importantly, today, as scientists are trying to predict and understand the global consequences of climate change, Humboldt's interdisciplinary methods and his idea that nature is one of global patterns, you know, remains resoundingly topical. And the other thing is that he looked at colonialism and the destruction of the environment as one system. So his insight that economic, social, and political issues are connected to environmental problems, you know, sadly, still right. incredibly right. important today.
Well, we're very lucky, Andrea, to have you write this book for us. It's a terrific book. I highly recommend it. And thank you for taking time to be with us, and good luck.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about Humboldt.
Andrea Wolf is the author of The Invention of Nature. I talked to her back in 2015 when her book came out. If this book sounds like a great read for your upcoming vacation, you're in luck, because the Sci-Fi Book Club is reading The Invention of Nature in August. Find out all you need to know, including how to win a free book. Oh yeah, on our website, sciencefriday.com/bookclub. That's sciencefriday.com/bookclub. Coming up, what if we could meet our energy storage goals by moving to solid-state batteries? A battery breakthrough right after this short break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. To meet green energy goals, experts argue that a crucial component will be a worldwide shift to batteries. For that to happen, we're going to need a lot more of them. And the current most popular kind of battery, you know, the lithium ion, is not a great candidate for this kind of scale-up due to its reliance on scarce resources, controversial mining practices, and polluting production processes. But solid-state batteries could offer some solutions here. That technology is still in development, but new research from teams at the University of Chicago and UC San Diego details a first-of-its-kind solid-state battery architecture that trades out the rare and problematic lithium for the much more abundant sodium. You know, the kind of stuff that's in salt. Their results were published in Nature Energy, and here to tell us some more about the advancement is my guest, Dr. Sherling Monk, professor of molecular engineering at UChicago and chief scientist for energy storage science at Argonne National Laboratory. And she was an author on that paper. Dr. Monk, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you. Let's talk a bit first about why we need more batteries for a greener power grid.
Well, as we transition to renewable sources like wind and solar, we all know that wind does not blow all the time, and we only get about 8 hours sunshine. So I think it's very important for us to have the energy storage mechanism to deal with the intermittency of these renewable energy sources. That's why battery is very, very critical for this energy transition.
You know, a lot of people haven't heard, I don't think, about solid state batteries. We've talked about it briefly on the show, but please give us a refresher on why they're such an appealing candidate for electric cars and this greener power grid.
Certainly. Solid state batteries is referring to replacing one of the important components in the battery, the flammable liquid, to solid materials. This will enable us to build the batteries with very high energy density while not sacrificing the safety aspect. We are all very excited with this possibility, because it's possible that we will now build an electric vehicle that per charge will lead to 500 miles. And it's possible that we can actually put the batteries in our house, just like a refrigerator for electrons. That provided us a lot of flexibility in terms of how we design the grid of the future.
You said something very important. You talked about the solid state battery having the same energy density of lithium batteries. That energy density concept is important, is it not? And how then do you build that into these new solid state batteries?
Yeah, so energy density refers to how much energy we can pack in certain weight, or how much energy we can pack in a fixed volume. So for instance, you know, the way how current cars, electric vehicles are designed, from outside you cannot really tell the difference if it's run on internal combustion engine or it's run on electromotor and the batteries. So the design constraint is that in that fixed volume, we have to put enough batteries that will keep the cars run the long distance. So I would say the energy density concept is a design design constraint that all the battery people have to work within. And this is the reason why lithium-ion batteries made such a positive impact in the electric vehicle, because you can't really use your AA batteries or your lead-acid batteries for that purpose because of their low energy density.
And your research actually helped overcome a problem that allows you to use these new batteries?
That's right. Yeah. As you mentioned in the beginning of the show, that lithium and what we use in the lithium ion batteries that contains nickel, cobalt, copper, those elements are scarce and they take a lot of energy to mine them. So the work we are doing is trying to get rid of those critical elements, build batteries based on abundant materials, for example, sodium. And then we actually can eliminate the copper and then just use aluminum as the current collector. And we can actually build batteries made with sodium, iron, manganese, oxygen. Yeah, so all those elements are what we call the rock-forming elements, and they are very abundant on the planet Earth.
And some hardware and electric car companies have started to use these solid-state batteries. Is that right?
In the prototyping stage, yes.
Yes.
I think for mass production, we still have certain hurdles to overcome.
Let's talk about the hurdles that need to be overcome and why you think that they can be overcome.
The way how current lithium-ion batteries are being scaled up, they're done in the factory called the gigawatt factories. And those process right now utilize very large areas to produce the lithium-ion batteries. And we are hoping that the process of making batteries could be further simplified and the efficiency could be improved. So in solid state battery manufacturing, the hurdles are, at the moment, it is still a nascent technology. So the gigafactories are built for lithium-ion batteries. So you can't really do a drop-in solution to make those solid-state batteries, that they require a reinvention of how the factory should look like. So I think this hurdle is rather challenging. And as many investments have already been made to scale the gigawatt factories worldwide, I think that the pioneers in this area for solid-state batteries really have to think about how we can do this with very strict timeline, and we actually have to showcase solid-state batteries indeed can outperform lithium-ion batteries. I think that scaling challenge is rather difficult.
Your research talks about you're making a big discovery, which is the development of anode-free architecture for sodium-based solid-state batteries. What is that, and why is that so important?
Sure. Let me just step back to talk about how the architecture of a lithium-ion battery is. So in any batteries, you need a negative electrode anode, and you need a positive electrode, cathode, and then you have the electrolyte. These three components are really critical. So in our architecture design, we figure out a way that during the manufacturing process, we can eliminate the need to fabricate the negative electrode, which is called anode. So we could imagine that the simplification of the manufacturing process could lead to multiple benefits. One of them is, of course, you simplify the manufacturing step. And the other one is that you can reduce the cost, because we are not implementing the negative electrode during the manufacturing process, but the anode will be formed during the first operation of the batteries. I think that's a novel concept that comes out from our research. Particularly, we are actually doing it with the chemistry that based on sodium, some kind of, you know, elements that everyone knows that very abundant, it's vastly available. So,
is that instead of lithium?
Exactly. Instead of lithium. In our battery, we don't need to use lithium. And the sodium, actually, if you recall the periodic table on the first column of the periodic table, sodium is right below lithium, a little bit heavier, But counterintuitively, people don't realize that sodium can move very fast. The sodium ions can move very fast in both liquid and the solid. So actually, the sodium solid-state batteries can also offer fast charging capabilities and a very high power rate. So we don't have to sacrifice much of the performances when we replace lithium with sodium.
Why didn't we do that just at the beginning? If it's so much easier.
Yeah, there's an interesting story here that sodium is not beyond lithium. We are behind lithium. In fact, initial research was initiated by a group of French scientists back in 1960s during the first oil embargo crisis. However, I would say the scientists who work on the lithium chemistry made their breakthroughs in enabling so-called intercalation chemistry. Yeah, I know it's a jargon, but basically they found the graphite can and the lithium cobalt oxide, you know, these two materials can reversibly insert and deinsert lithium for thousands of cycles. Yeah, so I think that one of the main reasons is that the lithium outperformed the sodium back in the 70s, and sodium was really behind.
So we're taking like a back to the future sort of
thing. Oh, I love that verse. Yeah, exactly. Back to the future.
Yeah. So is there a certain kind of application for sodium solid state batteries that they would really thrive in?
I certainly hope so. Even though I think our research is at a relatively low technology readiness level, we call it the TRL level 2 or 3. So we demonstrated the concept that sodium solid state batteries with anode-free architecture could work. But we project that the sodium solid state batteries can do as well as some of the lithium batteries. So you could imagine that if electrification for mobility is everywhere, I think in countries like India, China, actually in major metropolitan cities like Paris, Chicago, LA, we could actually use sodium batteries that provide driving ranges, you know, comparable to that offered by lithium.
Right.
So, yeah, I think the supply chain securities that being offered by sodium is very exciting. I think as a scientist, we typically don't think about the geopolitics, but in the field of energy transition, we don't have a choice. I think we do have to worry about the supply chain security. And I think the ability for us to make sodium-based batteries, diversify the choices for batteries, it's always a good thing when we have more diversified choices.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I know you're chief scientist for energy storage at the famous Argonne National Laboratory, a federal laboratory. How much of your work then and moving forward with sodium batteries and batteries in general depends on government incentives to keep this going?
I think it's an important role that the government incentive will play because the energy crisis and the climate change that we are facing, I think that in order to meet the time constraint that we probably have 2 decades to fix our grid of the future, I think that the government incentive will play a critical role in terms of how we could scale things fast and how we can actually make sure that localization, the domestic manufacturing of important energy storage technologies could happen. So Argonne actually back in 1992 is one of the first places in the United States that started research on energy storage, particularly lithium-ion batteries. I think we continue to focus on how we can actually provide the best efficient energy technologies for the U.S. And with the current focus is really trying to offer a very secure supply chains so that the domestic manufacturing of those important technologies could be accomplished.
Yeah, I understand the teams have filed a patent through UC San Diego for this discoveries. And whenever we get a new discovery, especially in energy, and you ask, when are we going to see this? It's always, well, it's just 5 years down the road, or it's 30 years away if it's fusion. It's always that, you know, that far in the distance. How long do you think it really will be before solid state battery tech is at a place where it could be manufactured on a large scale?
Yep. I think this crystal ball I have back in my office is really working quite well. So let me say a few things about the future of solid state batteries. I think a lot of people didn't realize that polymer-based solid-state batteries is already a commercial product. In fact, some people are riding those buses in Paris right now during the Olympics.
Really?
Yep. The lithium version of the solid-state batteries, I think the ones that are based on so-called ceramic-based solid-state electrolytes, many tier one manufacturing battery companies are working on it right now. Toyota has made a public announcement, followed by Samsung. And I believe the latest one probably is Nissan. I think that we will see some very interesting solid-state battery design commercial products probably 2027 or 2028. For the technology we are working on for sodium, I think that the manufacturing processes we could leverage on what's already been developed by the companies who are working on lithium solid state, sodium solid state can happen in the next 5 years, 5 to 7 years. I do want to emphasize that a lot of it will really depend on the determination of the entire society that we are indeed going for electrification of everything. I think there are a lot of doubts and the speculations that maybe we won't be able to do it. I hope that the sodium battery concept show people that lithium is not the only option, that we can make sodium batteries work. And perhaps in the future, some people will make aluminum batteries, magnesium batteries work. So I think the technology advancement for all these new battery chemistries are extremely exciting. So I want to tell you that in the next 3 to 5 years, we could expect some very, very exciting new solid state battery technologies coming online.
Well, I can't wait, Dr. Meng. Thank you for enlightening us on that. And we'll keep an eye out.
Pleasure to chat with you, Ira.
Dr. Shelley Meng, Professor of Molecular Engineering at the University of Chicago, Chief Scientist for Energy Storage Science at the famous Argonne National Laboratory. We have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk to the author of a cool new book all about the history and impact of refrigeration. Sort of a bird's eye view, if you know what I mean. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As we sweat through another torrid summer, imagine how much worse the heat would feel if you couldn't reach into the fridge for another cold one. Summertime is a good time to consider how much refrigeration has changed the way we exist, from keeping our food from spoiling to allowing us to survive on a warming planet. Most of us just can't imagine life without a fridge. John Dankosky is here with the story of how it all came about.
Thanks, Ira. A new book called Frostbite, How Refrigeration Changed Our Food, Our Planet, and Ourselves, looks at our relationship with the fridge and how it transformed how and what we eat. Nicola Twilley is the author of Frostbite and the co-host of the podcast Gastropod. Nikki, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so what is it about refrigerators that made you want to write a whole book about them?
Well, I mean, Americans are obsessed with refrigerators. We open them apparently on average 117 times a day, which I think has to have gone up since that study was done because it was pre-COVID. And now with all the work at home, Yeah, I spent a lot of time telling people about this book and being like, no, no, refrigeration's much cooler than you think. Ba-doom.
Ba-doom.
Exactly. So painful. It's a miracle any of my friends still speak to me. But really what I became obsessed with was refrigeration, not refrigerators per se, because your refrigerator is just the tip of the iceberg. And I mean that very literally. There's an entire artificial winter of refrigerated warehouses and trains and ships and trucks and juice tanks and ripening rooms and all sorts of weird spaces that you never imagine that lie kind of behind your fridge and that get your food from the farm to the table. And that's really how the fascination started for me. People were writing about farm-to-table. People were opening farm-to-table restaurants. This is a while back because I've been obsessed with this for a while. But people like Michael Pollan and Eric Schlosser were writing books that were like showing us the behind the scenes of our food. But they were covering the farm piece. And I was like, what about the two piece? What about how our food gets from the farm to the table? And so I decided to go take a peek in those spaces too. But then when I started looking there, I found the ways that we have found to extend the life of our food are totally weird and fascinating. You know, you hear about Silicon Valley guys doing all these bananas things to try and live longer, injecting themselves with the plasma of young boys, etc. This is so much weirder.
Well, you tell some of these stories about the weird things that we do. So let's take the story of the humble avocado. You know, so I live in Connecticut in the northeast of the U.S. So it's grown in California. Explain to me what exactly happens between when it's picked and when it gets to me at my grocery store, because there are some details in here that I just frankly can't believe.
So an avocado, when it's ripe, it's not a very shippable thing. We know this. It bruises very, very easily, right? And for a long time, that's why it was an extremely rare fruit, too. So what happened was the avocado farmers wanted to make their industry big, and they looked around and they found another squishy fruit that you can't ship when it's ripe, which is the banana. And they stole basically the banana playbook. So the deal is you harvest when the fruit is completely unripe, just green, hard, disgusting. And then you ship it around because it's hard and sturdy during this time. You obviously refrigerate it just to keep it fresh, to slow down its respiration, to stop it from getting any riper, to kind of freeze it in time. And then when it's reached, you know, the point of sale, it's a few days away from going onto the supermarket shelves, you do something called ripening. And this uses a gas called ethylene, which turns out to be the most produced organic molecule on Earth because it's the basis of all of our plastics, polyethylene. But in plants, it's a hormone. And it's just this sweet-smelling gas that you blast the avocados with, and it tells them, hey, it's time to ripen. And they ripen, and from that point onwards, their shelf life is very limited, and they have to be treated with the most tender care. But that's how they get onto your shelves. And it's a really delicate process because they get very hot as they ripen, and so you have to refrigerate them. Otherwise, they explode, and you just end up with guacamole all over the ripening room walls.
hold it. You have exploding avocados if you don't do this right?
Oh, yeah. Talk about control of nature. We are deliberately trying to sort of tell a room full of fruit, like, hey, it's time to ripen, something that would happen naturally on the vine. And when they all do it at once, they generate a lot of heat. So it's a very delicate process.
Okay, so there's a few different places where your book kind of broke my brain a little bit. And one of these times is when you talk about how orange juice is made. Now, if you're the sort of person that wakes up every day and drinks orange juice and loves your orange juice out of a box, you might not want to listen to this next part as you walk me, Nikki, through the life cycle of OJ.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, first of all, the carton is lying to you. It has a picture of an orange, you know, with some leaves. But listen on. It's nothing to be afraid of. The truth will set you free here. So if you have an orange tree in your yard because you live in California, Florida, or you've ever drunk fresh orange juice, you know it tastes different at different times of year. It also has a shelf life of about 24 hours, thereabouts, maybe 48. So what to do? And so the U.S. Army during the Second World War wanted to get orange juice, which is very high in vitamin C, as we know, to the soldiers as a way to make sure they had, you know, they didn't have to take supplements. They were getting everything they needed. Only problem was you couldn't can orange juice. And at the time, that was really the only way of preserving juice. You could can tomato juice and people had that for breakfast. But canning orange juice just really, the result tasted disgusting. So no one did it. So they came up, they used a method that had actually been developed at the Kodak labs for drying photographic film to think how this occurred to them, who knows. But to basically de-aerate and de-oil the juice. So you take out everything that gives it any flavor, because those are the volatile pieces. Those are the parts that will go bad over time. So you take them out, you concentrate it down, you're left with orange-colored sugar water. And guess what? It lasts forever. They have these tanks where it's just like these giant ice cream paddles going around, two-story-high tanks, full of this kind of viscous brown sludge just being stirred. And you can keep that for 2 years. The problem, of course, is that it doesn't taste of anything, right? If you add water back to that, it will be an orange sugary drink, but it won't taste of orange. But the genius is that the companies who figured this out, primarily Minute Maid at first, they saw what was a problem was actually an opportunity. Because you've taken out all the flavors by de-aerating and de-oiling it, you have to add them back in. But guess what? You can add them in at exactly the same ratio every time. And once you have something that tastes the same all year round, you have a brand and you have something that people can prefer, say, to other orange juices, the same way you might prefer Pepsi to Coke. And so it really takes off. And orange juice consumption, after this method comes in, orange juice consumption quadruples in a decade. It goes from nothing to being something that everyone has for breakfast.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there, but I'd like to turn back to produce. By the time that most of it has been delivered to us, it's pretty fundamentally different than when it was picked. Like, I don't know, my tomatoes are mushy, the strawberries are oozing sometime. How does refrigeration change the chemistry of these fruits and vegetables?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. It's done this in a couple of different ways. But the tomato is a classic example on a couple levels. Because for one, if you put it in your home refrigerator for 3 or 4 days, that's long enough. That exposure to the cold is long enough to switch off the DNA that is the machinery for creating flavor. The other thing is, okay, remember the problem of squishiness? Tomato is also very squishy when it's ripe. There's no way you're going to be shipping that around the country. The losses are going to be horrendous. You'll end up with sauce. So what they do is they have to harvest it when it is green and hard and unripe. And again, you gas it using this plant hormone when you're at the destination. And it ripens, sure, but it never ripens the same way off the vine as it does on. And the third piece is, well, because we wanted a tomato that we could ship around and, you know, basically practically play ping pong with, we bred for a tomato that we could do that. We bred for the sturdiest tomato possible. Guess what we didn't breed for? Flavor and nutrition. You can actually survey heirloom tomatoes and see which genes are missing from the commercial variety that we just bred out because they weren't useful in delivering the tomato of commerce.
There's actually a lot of fascinating chemistry and even engineering in things as simple as those salad bags that we get are pre-washed greens. And maybe you can talk about how those bags are designed to keep these delicate greens fresh while they're in the refrigerator.
Yeah, I mean, I have to confess, before I wrote this book, I just thought a salad bag was a plastic bag, like nothing special there. Actually, it turns out it's a high-tech respiratory apparatus. It is specifically creating the perfect atmosphere inside the bag to slow down how fast those leaves are breathing. So the trick with produce is once you harvest it, it's still breathing. They call it respiration technically, I think not to freak us out, but really it's breathing. And like us, it has a certain number of breaths it can take before it will die. And so the whole trick of everything we do to our produce is to make it breathe more slowly. Refrigeration slows down how fast produce breathes. So does it lowering the oxygen levels and tweaking the atmosphere very precisely. And so what those salad bags do is they are multiple layers of differentially permeable membrane, which just basically means they have different kind of microscopic holes in them that are tuned to let different amounts of the various atmospheric gases and water in and out of the bag, matched precisely to the leaves in the bag and how fast they're breathing and what they need. And that leaf mix, too, you think, oh, they put in the baby spinach and the arugula and the endive and the radicchio because they taste good together. No, no, no. They're balancing each other out. So baby spinach breathes really fast. It's so young. It, you know, we harvest it when there are only 5 true leaves on the plant. And it's just like, you know, radicchio is breathing much more slowly, much more chill. So you balance that out. You basically kind of put the blend together in the right ratio to get an even kind of breathing rate. And then you design the bag to match that. And then someone like you or me buys that bag, comes home, realizes it doesn't fit in our crisper drawer and opens it and ruins everything.
Okay, so of course, as the planet gets warmer, we're working harder to stay cool. And that goes for our food, too. How does refrigeration play into a warming world?
Yeah, this is the scary part, because of course, as the planet warms, we need to work harder to keep things cooler. And as, you know, much of the rest of the world develops and builds the same kind of food system that we have here in the U.S., you know, China's basically built that now, is still expanding. Sub-Saharan Africa is just embarking on building this, but it takes an enormous amount of power. So currently, about 2% of global electricity usage is for cooling food. That will increase at least 5-fold as the rest of the world comes online, and more if as temperatures rise. Plus, the chemicals we use to refrigerate food are actually global warming super greenhouse gases. So they're much more polluting than, say, carbon dioxide, many thousands of times more as they leak into the atmosphere. And so the combination is actually a disaster. And the irony is that, you know, as our natural ice caps, our natural cryosphere melts, the Arctic disappears, the Antarctic disappears, we're building this artificial winter, this artificial cryosphere that's expanding rapidly. I mean, it increased by 20% between 2018 and 2020 alone. So as that expands, the natural one shrinks and the two are connected.
Has all of this changed the way that you think about the food that you eat?
I mean, I definitely never open the salad bag just to squeeze it into my crisper drawer anymore. And yes, absolutely. Having seen kind of people who specialize in this kind of shudder in horror at the idea of putting a peach in the refrigerator, I never do that anymore either, because, I mean, I the words the stone fruit killing zone just kind of echo in my head. So definitely I have a sense, much more so I think, that the refrigerator is just one solution for keeping food fresh, and that also things don't get fresher in there. It's not a bank vault where you put something in and it stays exactly the same and you could take it out a week later. If you put that bag of spinach in there and you eat it a week later and it hasn't gone bad, you might be patting yourself on the back, but it's going to have half the nutrients it did when you first put it in. To me, it's just one of the ways that we preserve food. It's not the only way. It's not the best way. And it's definitely not necessarily the most sustainable way. And at the end of the book, I spend some time looking at, you know, people working on other ways to keep food fresh, because that's the thing to remember. For beer, we want it cold. For everything else, we want it fresh. And there's a lot of ways to do that. It doesn't have to mean cold.
I guess the last thing to ask you about, and you touched on this earlier when we were talking about taking that tomato and putting it in the refrigerator. I'm wondering if the food that we have today is just substantially different because of refrigeration than the food our grandparents had.
Oh, absolutely. And you can even see people foretelling that this will be the case. In 1911, there was a cold storage banquet held in Chicago to introduce people to this wild new food preservation technology that they were actually very suspicious of. And one of the editorials that came out around this kind of promotional meal to convince people that refrigerated food was safe and wouldn't kill them said, listen, it may not kill you, but it doesn't taste the same, and the only silver lining is that soon the generation that knows what fresh food tastes like will be dead, and the generations that follow will think that refrigerated food is fresh. That's, you know, we just won't know what we're missing. And when I read that, I got chills down my spine because we are that generation. We have forgotten what food tasted like before it met the cold chain. And, you know, I think we've lost out as a result. I should say, we have gained in other respects. You know, most of those people would never have tasted a banana, you know, or a ripe avocado. And again, so there's flavors that it's brought to our table, but there's flavors it's taken away.
Nikki, thanks for this interesting historical look at refrigeration. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This was fun.
Nicola Twilley is the author of Frostbite and co-host of Gastropod. To read an excerpt from Frostbite, you can head to sciencefriday.com/frostbite. I'm John Dankosky.
Thank you, John. And that about wraps up this week. If you missed any part of the program or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow. Have a good weekend.